Welcome to the RRM podcast. I'm Deborah Colleton. Today's topic is, what is restorative reproductive medicine? And I am delighted to be joined today by Dr. Phil Boyle, who is the president of the International Institute for Restorative Reproductive Medicine. Dr. Boyle is a general practitioner in Ireland, where he has treated thousands of patients facing infertility. He developed the RRM method called neofertility, and he has treated many patients who faced infertility, miscarriage, and even failed IVF. So we are excited to hear from Dr. Boyle. We're also joined by Dr. Lynn Keenan, who is board certified in internal medicine and sleep medicine. She is the president of the Institute for Restorative Reproductive Medicine of America. Welcome, both of you. So I'd like to just start the conversation with, what is restorative reproductive medicine and why do we need it? Medicine should be restorative. So why is this not redundant? Dr. Boyle, if you could start us off with just, what is restorative reproductive medicine? What makes it different?
Sure. Restorative reproductive medicine, there's an intuitive sense that people can often guess readily, well, what does this mean? And one of the difficulties we have is trying to convince our peers who provide fertility treatment that we're doing anything different than they are. Because as part of all of our training, we try to establish a diagnosis and implement treatment. And one of the key things that we do differently is we work with a fertility chart. And I tell people, if you're trying to solve the fertility conundrum without a fertility chart, it's like going to a new city and trying to find your way around it without a map. And this is basically our map that gives us an ability to navigate fertility for our investigations, for our treatments, and for balancing the cycle. So the key thing with restorative reproductive medicine is we work with a fertility chart, and then we implement new strategies of hormone assessment that aren't widely practiced. So that's a very important difference compared to our peers. And the other thing that's really different is we don't give up with medical balancing treatment after maybe 3 or 5 cycles. We do 12 cycles. And that makes a world of difference because everybody knows it's normal to take a year to get pregnant. So if you identify and treat and correct, you stay the course. Don't give up just because you're not landed after 6 cycles. Do it for 12 cycles. So they're probably the key things. Another thing that's worth mentioning is we're very fussy about the kind of surgery we get, because that really changes our outcomes. So myself and Dr. Keenan are both medical practitioners, but our practice would be hampered if we don't have excellent surgeons who do very specialized work to help our medical treatment work better.
And what about the fact that infertility, we now know, is typically multi-factor? So my understanding has always been that that's another big differentiator for RRM. And that you don't stop with one diagnosis, because we know actually there are typically multiple factors.
So the philosophy of restorative reproductive medicine is, if your fertility isn't working properly, being expressed through infertility or repeated miscarriages, there has to be a reason, and it's usually reasons plural. And it's rarely just single issue. And we implement what we refer to as a multifactorial restorative strategy. So in addition to hormone assessment and surgical intervention, that would be our bread and butter. Then we also look for things like chronic infections. We look for immune dysfunction. And then we look for general health issues as well. This heart, mind, emotions, and psychology is critically important. So we pull together usually about a half dozen or more things for each individual patient, tailor the treatment to what the individual needs. We also look very closely at the male factor, and there are multiple male interventions that we have as well. So that idea, you're absolutely right. This multifactorial restorative approach is key to restorative reproductive medicine as well.
So what would be like a really classic case of a couple with infertility, if there is such a thing?
I don't think there is such a thing as just, but I suppose one couple in particular that comes to mind to me is a more difficult couple that I treated. And I actually published it in a peer-reviewed medical journal as a case report, because it demonstrated a more extreme version of what we can potentially do. And this was a couple who had 16 years of infertility. They had 8 unsuccessful embryo transfers, and they had no successful pregnancy after all that time. So they came our direction, and we implemented our multifactorial strategy. We found a uterine septum. We found the hormone deficiency issues and immune dysfunction that needed attention, as well as a chronic low-grade infection. So we dealt with all of these things, and we helped her to achieve a successful pregnancy. So I just wanted to put that into the peer-reviewed literature as a case report, trying to explain, well, here's what we did step by step, that anybody can look that up. And our goal is, let's encourage every fertility clinic to implement a restorative strategy, because that's what we all should be doing anyway.
So I definitely want to talk more about infertility, but Dr. Keenan, could you tell us, because I know restorative reproductive medicine is not just for couples with infertility, but has other patient populations for whom it can be very helpful. So what are those other patient populations? Because we know it can be helpful for patients with infertility or miscarriage.
Yes, and much of my work, as I've recently retired from being a clinical professor of medicine, where I taught both ambulatory care as well as sleep medicine. And in that setting, I would often get my colleagues, you know, if a woman came in with a particular women's health issue, they'd say, oh, you do that alternative medicine thing. And I'd really correct them and say, no, really, I do the essence of where medicine is in every other field, where we try to understand the physiology, address what the problem is, and bring it back to the normal state of health, rather than create kind of a different definition of what's a normal state of health, where maybe the external hormones are given just to kind of flatline them, rather than this complex beauty of all these different cycles. And when I would teach the house staff, we'd always start off with just the beauty of how complicated all of these varying cycles of the different hormones are, where every day a woman is actually a different combination of hormones. So it really keeps the men in their lives kind of guessing. But when they see that we like go for what is she actually doing today? And what does her chart tell us? Like how much that gives us compared to if we were doing daily blood work. And so many things that it can treat for internal medicine, like the women with PCOS or the premenstrual headaches, or we've had people with the catamenial seizures. I've even had, when I was doing sleep medicine, women with narcolepsy have very unique charts. So it's like this map to women's health that is like so exciting that we can treat so much of the health problems that affect women in the reproductive years. But then also, it gives us clues of what are they at risk for as they get older? What are those key signs? I've never forgotten that really impressive lecture by Dr. Hilgers about you could look backwards at charts and see who's at higher risk of breast cancer or osteoporosis. And that was like so mind-blowing to me that there's so much to explore on the horizon. If more people were doing this, more women were charting, and more physicians knew how to understand it.
I've definitely heard so much of that anecdotally, that the chart of a woman's, and just for listeners, if you don't know, that by charting, we mean tracking of women's reproductive health biomarkers, and there are different biomarkers that can be tracked. That predictive value, is that anecdotal or is any of that proven? In other words, you can look at a chart and know X, Y, or Z.
There's some studies that are out there. I definitely think that they need to be repeated on a larger level, but there is definitely studies that show associations with higher risk of breast cancer, osteoporosis, maybe endometriosis.
And tell me how you each first encountered restorative reproductive medicine, how you wound up in this field. Dr. Boyle, do you want to start?
Yeah, well, I would have been part of the original founding group of it with Dr. Tracy Parnell and Professor Joe Stanford, got involved very soon after that. So we started in 2000. So we're 25 years in existence as a group. I'm 30 years in practice. So it was a very welcome development. And it's great to see 25 years later, we're still growing and expanding. Our goal and our vision with restorative reproductive medicine is, it's come from a very strong Catholic identity. And as a group, we wanted to really say, well, we don't need to make everybody Catholic through this or convince people of different things from a religious point of view. This is science. This is medicine. This can stand on its own two feet. So while Catholic things would be important to me personally, they're not that important to lots of other people who want to work in this area. So we'd say, well, can we just look at the science and have somebody else talk about the theology another time? And why don't we look at this, this, and this? So we really tried to make this a very strong scientific medical perspective. And we've been gradually working at that for the last number of years.
So that's really interesting. Talk about why this has Catholicism at its origin. And my understanding is that it's essentially a necessity is the mother of invention story, where since Catholic teaching prohibits use of assisted reproductive technology, for example, for infertility, if you're Catholic and you're a medical professional and you're following that teaching, you have to make the reproductive function improve and optimize. It's the only way to achieve pregnancies. I grew up not Catholic, and when I became pregnant through restorative reproductive medicine, my non-Catholic family said, oh, well, this completely makes sense that the Catholic people are the ones who figured out how to have a baby when you can't have a baby. So is it in fact a necessity is the mother of invention story, or how is it that it wound up so Catholic in its origin?
Well, I think Dr. Professor Thomas Hilgers was the pioneer of real restorative reproductive medicine with his approach. And he, when he's a fourth year medical student and Catholic teaching came out through Humanae Vitae, he saw this as a personal call from God, and he was on a mission from God to bring this work to the world. Now, most of the rest of the world, all of academia, found IVF, and they were all excited about it. And they said, oh, all that other stuff is so boring and IVF is so exciting. Let's put all of our attention and energy this direction. But like you said, well, Dr. Hilgers, from a faith perspective, he'd no other option. So he did the trying to stay within the Catholic guidelines forced him to go down a route that most of the rest of the medical profession decided to ignore because it is a bit more boring on one level. But I don't find it boring currently because there's so many options that we've got. But I think that's what drove it. I'd kind of like to think, well, maybe Jehovah's Witnesses would find an alternative to blood transfusions because of their faith perspective. And people who don't agree with their faith shouldn't disregard a good scientific discovery if they happen to come up with it.
Good analogy. And I just read an interesting perspective the other day on IVF from Sir Robert Winston, who is one of the pioneers of making improvements to IVF. He said the main causes of infertility are not being properly treated. A key to bad medicine is not to make a prognosis, but just to treat the symptoms. And that's actually what we're doing. We're treating the symptoms of infertility rather than trying to understand it. So it does seem that there is just this infatuation with the technology of IVF, and almost the entire world has just charged off in this direction. And now we're adding egg freezing and pre-implantation diagnoses and donor eggs and donor sperm. I mean, there will only be a matter of years before you can order a baby essentially on Amazon.
Here's the other thing. Couples want to get pregnant with a restorative approach. So I think as physicians, we need to listen to that. So if a couple has any capacity to conceive through regular intercourse, every couple would choose that. And it's because their desire to have a baby is so strong, they will choose something like in vitro fertilization most reluctantly because they want to have a baby. So I think that in terms of understanding, well, what do couples want? They want to identify, diagnose, solve the problem, and conceive through their own loving embrace rather than have a third-party technical intervention in between all of that.
And tell us about patient reaction to how well-known is restorative reproductive in Ireland, because I feel that it's not that well-known in the United States, but you've developed a reputation in Ireland. Tell us about patient reaction and specifically patient reaction from couples who have failed with IVF.
So I'm going on to the next generation of patients at this stage, which is a little disturbing to me. When I started out, I was younger than most of my patients. And now patients are coming to me and they're saying, my mother came to you for treatment. I'm going, oh my gosh, I've been doing this far too long. But Ireland is a smallish place and we've got a population of under 5 million. And you know the way there's 6 degrees of separation and people talk? I think it's about 2 degrees of separation in Ireland. Anywhere you go, you meet somebody who knows somebody, and it's a very small connected community. So that's very beneficial. So word of mouth is the main thing that has kept me going. I did think that I would convince my peers in medicine that this is a good, logical, rational, scientific approach to medicine and to fertility treatment. And to my surprise, I thought it might take 5, maybe 10 years. I can't believe I've been this long doing it. and I haven't drawn more physicians into this area of work. And that's what the restorative reproductive medicine and the Institute is about, is to try and make more and better scientific arguments. And in recent years, we've had more publications to try and specifically focus on the science and say, come on, guys, you can do this as well. It is doable and it does work and it's what your patients are looking for.
I read a study that I believe was based on your clinic. This is a new paper in the Journal for Restorative Reproductive Medicine, the JRRM.
They're killing me with this publication, Deb, because we had to go back and drill down and get a lot more data. So in fairness, we did have a degree of superficial data, which made the point that we are comparable to the live birth rates that you would get for a single cycle of in vitro fertilization in the United States.
Well, the thing that caught my attention where it said pathological findings underlying infertility included decreased estrogenic cervical mucus production, intermenstrual bleeding, luteal phase defects, and suboptimal estrogen and progesterone levels. None of these diagnoses had been considered in patients previously assessed and treated under the traditional infertility approach within reproductive medicine.
Yeah, we have a raft of additional diagnoses that aren't even thought of by our peers, and that's true.
Okay, so these are the cycle-specific diagnoses that are not even contemplated in conventional medicine.
Well, we've developed insights because of our focus on the fertility tracking and the way we assess the hormones and the way we look at the impact of treatment. We actually understand the cycle much, much better than our peers who don't have that same degree of focus. And I'm absolutely shocked at how poor cycle hormone treatment is outside of restorative reproductive medicine. And I don't say it to be disrespectful to my peers who aren't trained in this area. And I'm trying to say, guys, you don't know what you're missing. You can get so much more and get so much detail if you just do this. But it disturbs me how poor their assessment and cycle balancing techniques are relative to what restorative reproductive medicine
can offer. Women are routinely dismissed or even ridiculed when they bring up cycle tracking. Dr. Keenan, what has it been like for you engaging colleagues about restorative reproductive medicine in California?
Again, I did have a really unique setting of teaching both sleep medicine and internal medicine. And when I would have the residents rotate through with me, if like a sleep patient didn't show up or something, then I'd say, okay, it's time for the restorative reproductive medicine lecture. And they weren't exactly ready for what I was going to tell them. But we had quite a very diverse group of residents. I probably had more people from like the Muslim, Hindu, Sikh faith or no faith at all compared to like the Catholic or Christian faith. And it was so rewarding because I would get through the lecture for about 45 minutes. And I remember this one very reserved gentleman from India, and he like jumped up and he said, "This is groundbreaking. My wife and I have been struggling with infertility for a year and we wanted to get to the cause of it." And his wife had some autoimmune disease. And so I helped him get pregnant, use some low-dose naltrexone, progesterone support. And yes, she had a very successful pregnancy. And so that is probably the most common reaction that I get is, this is real science. We should all be doing this. Why isn't it being taught in medical school? And again, that was probably the hardest question that I received, because I don't have a good answer for why isn't it, other than people don't really understand it. And so again, appreciate this podcast to try to get out about this core, beautiful science. You'd asked about like, what was my response from patients? And probably the most common reaction from patients was that, why did I have to get on the internet, search myself to find you, and drive 3 hours to find a restorative reproductive medicine doctor? So there is such a great need. And that's the goal of both IRMA and the IRM, is let's educate more and get them more in practice, more up to date.
Right. This sort of gets to my point of, no one's really heard of this. They don't know about it. And at some level, it's counterintuitive, because why do I need restorative medicine when regular medicine should be restorative? But talk to us, Dr. Keenan, about how you're making progress, perhaps working toward a formal subspecialty in restorative reproductive medicine, or how do we break through and raise the visibility and awareness of this approach and work toward formalizing it where it's taught in medical school, where it's incorporated into normal care. Is that even possible? Is that a future that you are contemplating?
I think that's where we have to go. We have to get it more well-known in the medical schools, in the residencies, as well as for all those who have already graduated, somehow get that message out, whether it's just an add-on certification or its own board certification as a kind of add-on like sleep is, where people of many different specialties can come through the sleep medicine fellowship. But that's definitely where we need to go.
How specifically do you do that, though? I mean, you've been at it for decades here, and I know sleep medicine, in which you're a specialist, used to not be a formal field of medicine. So are there lessons in that process for RRM? Or talk to us non-medical people about how something becomes a field of medicine.
So it certainly starts out with kind of smaller groups getting excited about it. When journals start getting where you can exchange those ideas faster, it really does get boosted to go a little faster. So I'm so excited about the Journal of Restorative Reproductive Medicine. You know, the conferences help. I do think we need to start getting more medical students in. Definitely a shout out to FACS that Dr. Duane is very good at getting the medical students. But it also needs to be, I think, people going to, like, I would do grand rounds about this, about every couple years. And so it's also like working on the faculties of getting them to understand so they get excited about it. Because really, of all the areas of medicine that I did do, because I did hospital medicine, outpatient medicine, sleep medicine, and restorative reproductive medicine, this one is the funnest. So if anyone's even thinking about it, like there's so much to explore, I would like highly encourage them. Then after that, then there has to be something like, we call them rogue boards, where the people that are in it come up with like, okay, what is like the benchmark for some, for you to know that you've got all the qualifications that you would be an expert in that area. So we do need like these, before it goes to the American Board of Medical Specialties, they want to see like, okay, do you have like some sort of a benchmark? That would be kind of the next thing. And then when there's kind of a critical number, which might be somewhere around 5,000 practitioners that have kind of gone through that training, and that there's some unique fellowships at least scattered through the country. I think it was somewhere around 25 to 50 when most new fields of medicine develop. So we do have a ways to go on that. But at that point, then someone can request the Board of Medical Specialties to do this as an added certification. So we have our work cut out to do.
What's the timeline for something like that?
In sleep medicine, from like where we are now in restorative reproductive medicine before it got to be a board certification, I would probably say in the 10-year range, maybe 5 years if we really get going. I'd like to be more optimistic, but I think that's a little more realistic.
And Dr. Boyle, is restorative reproductive medicine different? I know you're president of an international organization, so I'm wondering, is it different throughout the world? I mean, I can identify a number of features of the U.S. healthcare system that would exacerbate the problem that we see with infertility, for example, where we're really geared towards short, superficial visits, frankly, and writing prescriptions and using tech to just solve problems and not doing the deeper dive. In that sense, I think infertility is kind of a microcosm, an intensified microcosm of a bigger healthcare system-wide problem. And that makes me wonder, is it the same in Ireland and in Europe, or is it less of a problem? The problem being an over-reliance on in vitro fertilization instead of trying to identify underlying factors. Do you have a view on that as you look at your colleagues throughout the world, as I know you have a number of experts that who belong to your international organization?
Yeah, that's a lot in that, Deb. So I think the first part of that is many doctors who practice restorative reproductive medicine would have significant differences in how we practice. But we also have many things in common. And what happens from our own clinical experience, we each can become convinced that this particular approach is really effective. And what we want to do through the International Institute of Restorative Reproductive Medicine is to compare outcomes, which is not an easy thing to do because you have to take multiple things into account. If your population has an average age of 37 and 20% of them have tried and failed IVF compared to younger women who have not tried IVF, you got a different population to work with. So what we need to do is we've published retrospective studies looking at a difficult practice population. The next step, I think, in our evolution on our way to becoming a recognized specialty is now we need prospective studies, and ideally to compare it with other techniques such as in vitro fertilization. And from my clinical experience, I'm convinced restorative reproductive medicine would be superior on every level. What happens is women get healthier. They feel good when they go through the treatment. Same with the guys, because there's a whole restorative andrology that we're looking at as well. So male and female, we improve their health. We improve their communication because the process is the thing they're working on together. We balance their cycle. And our goal is, we say, get you healthy, get you happy, get a balanced cycle. Make sure you confirm it by ultrasound and hormone assessment. And if you're not pregnant after 4 or 5 cycles, get one of our good surgeons and enjoy the process and give it the 12 cycles. And what we find is because we identify and treat the multiple things that Dr. Keenan was talking about, then you don't have chronic inflammation, autoimmune conditions, hormone deficiency, DHEA deficiency, whatever it is, you've identified and addressed all of those. And I've had so many people say, you know what, we would love to have a baby, but we've already gained so much. We're getting on a whole lot better. My health is better. Life without premenstrual syndrome, it's really good. And a lot of women will continue that medication beyond the fertility journey as well. And the other thing that's massive with restorative reproductive medicine, it's not just about having one baby and we got you over the line. It's full term, normal weight, healthy mom, healthy baby, and it's repeat pregnancies as well. The patient I mentioned to you earlier who had 16 years of infertility and 8 unsuccessful embryo transfers, after she delivered her baby, she spontaneously conceived with no medications and is just about to deliver baby number 2. But I didn't even need to see her. So that's what the potential that we have with this work.
We just had one of those at the Reply Clinic as well. And I don't know if that's been studied, but clearly, anecdotally, within the field, there's a lot of that happening, the subsequent pregnancies, which is incredible. Because, of course, when you're relying on IVF, you do need to go back each time for this invasive, expensive, arduous process. What about, obviously, neither IVF nor RRM is a guarantee of a biological child. How do you coach those couples, Dr. Boyle? It must be really heart-wrenching when it's not effective.
So it really helps. You begin with the end in mind. So on day one, the first thing I tell everybody is, I can't make anybody pregnant. And you can't make yourself pregnant. So what we can do is work on your health, work on all the investigations and treatments that we've got, and generate the most favorable environment that will allow that conception may occur. And then we hope that it will happen before reaching our target end date, which is usually about 12 cycles after we've corrected everything. So typically, we've got about 2 cycles to assess and prepare, about another cycle or 2 to balance all the different things. So 3 or 4 cycle lead-in, and then you count your 12 cycles. And often it's about 18 months, you can say that you've really completed the treatment. And the whole time as we're going through it, one of the words that we give to people is, there's nothing quite like quitting to get you pregnant. And I'd sit and I'd look at them and say, how do you both feel about saying, we're not trying anymore? They kind of look and they're a bit nervous. We really want to have a baby. And they don't always intuitively get that. I say, I know. And it's because you want a baby. Therefore, big sigh of relief. We need to stop trying. So you might have heard of Rory McIlroy, did you? So big professional golfer. So I hate golf. Can't play it. Can't watch it. Even Rory, he's Irish and we're very proud of him and his recent major win in the Green Jacket and Augusta and all of that. But what he's learned the hard way, he had buckets of talent and he's blown it so many times because it mattered so much and he wanted it so bad. So if you bring the pressure, stress and intensity to try and make something happen, look out, it's not going to go the way you want. And it's the same thing with fertility. And I say, unfortunately, our process is much more like golf. You cannot bring the pressure, stress, intensity. You bring the process, you enjoy the process, you let it go, you allow it to happen. And these guys, you better believe, they're driven. They really want that result, but they're clever. So that whole philosophy, but then also to accept, there does come a time where we may not be serving your best interest, persisting with medicated cycles indefinitely. You need a target end date. And sometimes you get to the point where we would admit, this is terrible. We've really done our best. it looks like it's going to escape us. But if that does happen, what I tell people is, although the percentages are smaller, we're never at a point of impossibility. We'd say, well, it's time to close this chapter of all these medicated cycles. We've done the best we can, but we never give up on the hope of a surprise pregnancy beyond the medicated cycle. So our strategy is we've stopped the medications and let's see if we make it a surprise beyond the medicated cycles, because obviously everybody who works with fertility knows that that happens as well. People then wrestle with the idea, well, what will we do next? What are our next steps? And say, well, it's for you to discern as a couple. Your remaining options are, do you try a cycle of IVF? And that's for you as a couple to decide. If we can't get you there despite our best efforts, what about adoption? What about nothing? So these are things they need to explore as a couple themselves if we feel we've taken them as far as we can.
And talk about the different treatment of miscarriage. In other words, there's sort of a prevailing idea, in at least in the United States, that miscarriage is normal and inevitable, and you just try again. It's not really super remarkable. Maybe if you have several, it starts getting really quite remarkable. But my understanding with RRM is that any miscarriage is really warrants evaluation. And in fact, some risk of miscarriage can be identified prospectively.
That's the key. So if somebody is tracking their fertility cycle for fertility awareness and family planning, everybody's into taking their folic acid and doing a bit of exercise and preparing for three cycles before they try to get pregnant. Well, while you're doing that, why don't you track your fertility cycle and see if there are any red flags there? Do you have a normal menstrual bleeding pattern? What about the mucus flow? What about the timing of ovulation, the length of the luteal phase, period pain, premenstrual syndrome? All these things are screaming at us from the fertility chart. And we can also see very quickly if these things are within normal parameters. And our take on it is, you don't even need to have one miscarriage to say it's a problem. We can preemptively intervene and correct in a balanced cycle even before a couple attempt conception in the first place. So it does cause a little bit of a challenge, because then they don't have the official diagnosis of infertility or miscarriage in the first place, but we can see these at-risk cycles. So we have to be careful not to overstate, because they're not yet officially a patient. But from our clinical experience, it's screaming at us and say, well, again, we're never absolute. You can get away with really poor hormones and a terrible cycle and just get away with it, but your percentage risk is much higher. So I'm more risk averse, and I want to do everything I can to optimize the preconception environment, because I've seen too many adverse outcomes. So that's the context to give it to people in. But this radical departure, here's another thing. The NICE guidelines in the UK are telling couples under 30, well, do you know what the live birth rate is in year number two? So you've got an 80% live birth rate for the first year of trying to get pregnant. So those 20% of couples who aren't pregnant in the general population, the chance of them getting pregnant is 50% just by persisting for a whole other year. And that's better than most fertility programs. So they're being told if they're under 30, well, because you're young, you can wait 2 years before you go for any intervention or treatment, because 50% is pretty good. And they point to a paper that supports that. So 2 years, and you can have a cycle with that is terribly abnormal that we can see it screaming and say, no, you don't even need to wait a cycle. You can jump in much earlier.
We live in the 24-hour society, so they want something tomorrow. And you famously have said, Dr. Boyle, it's not about getting pregnant as quickly as possible. It's about getting pregnant as healthily as possible. That message, I think, needs more attention. And like, talk about, for example, the difference in outcomes for health of the mother and health of the baby with natural restorative care versus assisted IVF.
Yeah, so that's where our incidence of low birth weight, premature delivery, it's 3 times higher with in vitro fertilization compared to restorative reproductive medicine. When we do a comparison of our retrospective data, small numbers compared to the big numbers that we're comparing with in vitro fertilization. So rightly, the scientific critics would say, that's a retrospective study. You can't do a direct comparison. And that's true. So we can see a trend in that direction. And with a threefold difference, that's a big difference. So it's very likely if we do prospective studies, we'll find that that's a true and genuine finding. So the idea is, and what we suspect, the reason they get intrauterine growth retardation and premature delivery is because they haven't dealt with the root problems underlying, like Dr. Keenan mentioned, if they have an autoimmune condition that needs to be addressed, or if they haven't had their hormones balanced, if they have a chronic endometritis, endometriosis, all of these things, if we intervene, insulin resistance, and we've also published in low DHEA, these all have a massive part to play. So you identify, you correct, you get her healthy, and then full-term, normal weight, healthy baby. And I see this in our 40-plus-year-old women who are notorious for having premature delivery and low birth weight babies. We don't see that. We tend, the vast majority are normal, full-term, healthy babies.
That's fascinating. That's incredible. What are you looking forward to as the International Institute? What are your, you've just started a new medical journal, which is very exciting. Congratulations. And your first article on infertility was really terrific. We can maybe link to it in the podcast content. What are your goals in the near future for the Institute? What are your next milestones to make all of this work be better known?
I think we just have to stay with our task of continually reminding people, this is science, this is medicine. We take a very detailed history. We perform specific investigations. We establish multiple diagnoses. We treat in a systematic, methodical way, and then we give it the time. Now, it is very difficult because in our medical training, we've got 10 minutes maybe with our patients, but with restorative reproductive medicine in my practice, we give 40 to 45 minutes. So it's a completely different change of gear and a shift of emphasis. And there's a huge amount of doctor-patient interaction over a prolonged period of time. So that it does limit how many people we can see. And it's very much hands-on. It's also rewarding for the physician then because you get a connection with the couple and it really matters to them. And it comes across to them that we're impatient as physicians and we're hurt if it doesn't work or if they have a miscarriage and we're journeying with them and really rooting for them to try and get them over the line as well. So you do develop that bit more of a connection with your couples, which is, it's a nice way to work with people. And when I started in this work, I remember a well-intentioned professor said to me, you're just going to give people false hope. They're going to buy into this. They're going to believe this. And they're going to be really traumatized. They're a very delicate, sensitive group, you know, and you're giving them something that is unproven. So that's something that stayed with me. And I really tried to be very clear, very direct about what it is that we're doing and what our abilities as well as our limitations are. But to my surprise, as we progressed with the treatment, the idea that there is no such thing as false hope. There's either hope or there's no hope. And when you have hope, even if the promise isn't fulfilled at the end, they can see that they were treated very well and it was very logical, very human, very compassionate and a positive experience, even if we don't get the right result. So I've had so many people who have thanked me for the process and the way we treated them, even if they don't have baby in hand at the end of the process.
Dr. Keenan, what would be your message for anyone listening to this podcast who's struggling currently?
For the patients, I would absolutely recommend them to learn how to chart. You know, there's some really good apps out there if you can't find a fertility advisor, although I think that helps so much for that personal connection. And usually if they start seeing problems on the chart, they will refer to a restorative reproductive medicine physician. I do think that we need a little bit better marketing to get more of the doctors that are doing it out there so people know where to find them.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, the illustrious Dr. Phil Boyle from Ireland and the multi-talented Dr. Lynn Keenan from California. I wish you all the best, and I'm excited to see the progress made with your two RRM medical societies. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Deb.
To ask questions about RRM or to learn more about restorative reproductive medicine, you can contact us at replyfertility.com/podcast. Keep up to date about RRM by following us on your favorite podcast or social platform. All the links are in the show notes. Thank you for listening to the RRM podcast, and we'll see you next time.